On the Philosopher's Zone this week with me, Alan Saunders, a seriously enigmatic piece of Chinese philosophy, the Tao Te Ching. The Tao that can be told is not the eternal Tao. The name that can be named is not the eternal name. The unnameable is the eternally real. Naming is the origin of all particular things. Free from desire, you realize the mystery. Caught in desire, you see only the manifestations. Yet mystery and manifestations arise from the same source. This source is called darkness. Darkness within darkness, the gateway to all understanding. That was the whole of the first chapter of the Tao Te Ching, a work of Chinese philosophy whose influence it is just not possible to underestimate. But what does it mean? Well, let's start at the beginning. What does Tao Te Ching mean? Here's Dr. Karen Lai, Senior Lecturer and Philosophy Discipline Coordinator at the University of New South Wales.
Jing means a treatise or a text, and Tao and Te are concepts, you could say, that belong to Taoism. So if you wanted to translate it very loosely, it would mean a treatise on the idea of Tao and on the idea of Te.
Right. And so what do these two ideas, Tao and Te, what do they mean?
Oh, you'd be asking me to translate 3,000 years of work, Alan, or more. The notion Tao in Chinese philosophy can refer to a whole range of things, as you probably do know. A lot of Chinese terms are extremely malleable or flexible, and Tao can mean teaching, it can mean way, it can mean the path to get to the way. So it can mean a whole range of things. Te has traditionally been translated as virtue, but many scholars agree now that that's a post-Confucian understanding of Te. In more ancient texts, pre-Confucian texts, Te could mean something like the power of an individual. Much like, actually, essence in Aristotle.
And do we know anything about the circumstances of its composition?
Well, enough to say that it is not a single authored text, and it's not even clear when it was compiled. There are different versions of the text, and indeed the received version has now been dated, the received version that scholars have been studying for the last 2,500 years, has now been dated a little bit later than a text which was recently unearthed. Of course, this was during the pre-printing days, and so scholars who, or thinkers rather, who were aware of ideas basically remembered them, or they copied them from, you know, different bits and pieces that they had together. So in that sense, therefore, it should be unsurprising to find many different versions of the one text. You know, some would sit and copy. In fact, there is a version of the Tao Te Ching where the last, you know, where the last 38 chapters have now been put onto the front, and it's been called the Te Tao Ching. So it's in the nature of copying, really, that frustrates any attempt to try to pin down the details of the composition of the text.
If you buy a cheap paperback English translation, which is what I've done, it's attributed to somebody called Lao Tzu. Mm-hmm. Did he exist? Did he write it? Did he write any of it?
Well, there is a mention of a man called Lao Tzu who met with Confucius, and this is written by a Chinese historian about 400 years later. Scholars now think that if the person Lao Tzu did exist and if he did write something, it will be extremely difficult to make those connections, first to discover the person or to unearth the person, and secondly then to say this person wrote, you know, particular sections of the book. One of the difficulties is that the person who is called Lao Tzu, Lao translates literally to old, and Tzu means master. So how are we going to find a person called Old Master?
Now, Taoism is sometimes presented to us as a religion. Should we see it as a religion or as a philosophy? Or is that a Western distinction and not a Chinese distinction?
Well, the term Taoism in English, I believe, has two references. And one refers to a whole series of texts that philosophers study. In a quite separate context, Taoism has been used to describe religion, a whole entire, you know, religious traditional practice that is still well and truly alive today. These practices have somewhat to do with what's being said in the text, but the connection is very, very loose. Within the Chinese intellectual tradition itself, scholars normally distinguish the two. One, they call it Dao Jia, which refers to some of the teachings associated with the text, and the other they associate with Dao Jiao, which is associated with the religion. So in Chinese, yes, these two are quite separate and distinct. It's just unfortunate that in English, it's the same word we have for two quite different things.
Well, let's look at some of the basic concepts of the Tao. What is the difference between the Yu and the Wu?
Maybe I'll start at the beginning. I might talk a bit about different ways of interpreting the Tao Te Ching, simply because a lot of the language in there is rather open. It's more suggestive and more metaphorical. And so commentators have a lot of fun with it. From the philosophical angle, a traditional position is to understand the Tao Te Ching as a text that deals with metaphysics. In that regard, the concept Tao is a notion that relates to being, is a notion that relates to ontology, that tells you about reality. More recently, scholars have also started looking at epistemological approaches to the text, which then see the text as a criticism of what's going on then in Chinese society. In that regard, then, if we take the metaphysical approach, the Yu is often translated as being and the Wu as non-being. There's quite a lot of scholarship that has been spent on this topic, and there's also been comparative philosophical studies, for instance, between Chinese philosophy and continental philosophy to talk about being and non-being. When we look at these two ideas from the epistemological perspective, Yu can be understood as what we see. The term Yu can literally mean to have or to be present. And so from an epistemological perspective, Yu means to see and Wu means not to see. Taken from that point of view, the treatise then becomes one which seems to discuss what we are conditioned to see, what our current norms condition us to perceive, to see, and what we miss out, what we fail to see, given that we see the world with a particular pair of spectacles, so to speak, the ones that we've grown up with. I'll give a good example to illustrate that. One of the passages in the Tao Te Ching talks about the utility of being and non-being, or rather the utility of Yu and Wu. It talks about doors and windows, and it says frames are used to make doors and windows, but it is in its Wu, what we do not see, where the door has its full utility. So that becomes a kind of epistemological take on the text.
Where do you think the strength of the work lies then? In ethics, in metaphysics, or as you seem to be inclined to say, in epistemology, in the theory of knowledge?
I think you could take it either way. When I say either way, I mean either the metaphysical path or the epistemological path. The ethical connotations and implications of the text, I think, are dependent on which of these approaches you take. I tend to think that its value lies in the epistemological approach, although I must emphasize that the dominant approach is still the metaphysical one. So I'm off center, really, when I say I prefer the epistemological approach. There is value in the metaphysical approach in that scholars who take on this view suggests that there's another way of understanding reality. So in comparative philosophy, this is extremely valuable in pushing the boundaries of what is traditional Western philosophy, a traditional Platonic understanding of the world. And the epistemological view I've, you know, expressed already.
We might turn to another brace of concepts, Wu Wei and Ziran. Now, you would argue, I think, that they provide a unifying ethical framework for understanding the philosophy of the Tao Te Ching.
Mm-hmm. I interpret Ziran as spontaneity. Again, there is quite a lot of flexibility in this term. It could mean literally nature, literally, you know, the trees, the wind, and so on and so forth. And there are passages in the Tao Te Ching that explicitly refer to elements in nature. It could also refer to spontaneity, which one could argue many passages in the text see as a key characteristic of nature. So the term can be used at the same time to describe this defining characteristic of nature as well as nature itself. If you take the metaphysical view, then you would say, look, Ziran is about nature and Wu Wei is about a method of non-coerciveness, is a method of letting things be, letting nature take its course, going with the flow, and so on and so forth. If you take the epistemological view, which I take, that understands Ziran as spontaneity. It's more the characteristic feature rather than the natural things in selves that is valued. And if we appreciate spontaneity, then the resulting implication is that the Taoist sage who governs must govern the people mindful of their spontaneity. In other words, the Taoist sage should refrain from imposing too many constraints and so on and so forth. This indeed was one of the key aspects of Taoist criticism of Confucian approaches and indeed the status quo of the day, that was to impose standards for people's behavior. And the Taoists could be seen as wanting to wind that back. So this would, you know, then lead you to a lot of ethical implications.
On ABC Radio National, you're with the Philosopher's Zone, and this week we're talking about the Tao Te Ching, a great work of Chinese philosophy from around the 6th century BC. Now, Tao means the way, but there may be more than one way. According to Wang Keping, professor at the Beijing International Studies University, who's been in Australia lecturing on the Tao Te Ching, there are three sorts of Tao.
I think these three types of Tao reflect the moral dimension in Tao Te Ching, or possibly sociological dimension in a sense. And the first type of Tao is the Tao of heaven. And the second type of Tao is the Tao of human. The third type of Tao is the Tao of the Taoist sage. And these three types of Tao are all derived from a very interesting analogy, that is the bow drawing analogy. Okay, it seems like you draw a bow. When it aims high, you lower it. When it is lower, you raise it. So there's a very interesting description that the Tao of heaven reduces what is excessive and then supplements what is insufficient. But in striking contrast, the Tao of human is rather different. The Tao of human reduces the insufficient and then adds to the excessive. And here it implies something like the law of the jungle in a human society. So Lao possibly describes these two kinds of Tao as what he observes, but he offers a third alternative, the Tao of the sage. The Tao of the sage, by and large, means it works for others, but never compete with others. So I think he offers the Tao of the sage as the model for human beings to act upon. So that is the way, not only for moral cultivation, but also to reduce the social conflicts.
So we are to see the Tao as something that we as individuals seek to attain.
Yes, okay. Because when we read the Tao Te Ching as a Taoist book, we find it just one channel of moral teaching or whatever. But if you compare it to some texts by the Confucianists, we might see the sort of for critical reflection and also possibly the differences. But anyway, Lao Tzu really argued that and encouraged people to pursue the Tao. And even he offered different teachings. For instance, have fewer desires and reduce your selfishness. And try to purify yourself, your mind of, cares and worries, and then try to exercise a deep contemplation of the Tao as such. And try to follow the Tao of spontaneity or naturalness, and then you become your true self. So that possible way to attain, we call it spiritual freedom and independent personality. So this involves a sort of social detachment rather than social commitment.
But if I become myself, does this mean cultivating certain virtues? Karen Lai.
Certainly, the Taoist text does identify a whole series of characteristics. I'm not sure I'd call them virtues, but a whole series of characteristics that it holds in higher esteem, so to speak, including non-assertiveness, femininity, submissiveness, and so on and so forth.
What does he mean by femininity?
Passages in the text speak explicitly about the male and the female, and some of them go on to uphold the way of the female. Some of the passages can in fact be quite graphic, so to speak. It says, the female takes the weaker position, and by taking the weaker position, it lies underneath.
What about the application of Taoism in dealing with the issues of our time? How can the concepts of Tao and De in the Tao Te Ching be invoked, for example, as I think you would, to support an account of environmental holism?
Mm-hmm. Well, what I might argue is that in challenging the received norms of the day and the accepted practices, the Tao Te Ching in fact challenges the entire conceptual framework of what was going on. It challenges the imposition of standards and proposes spontaneity instead. It also challenges the assertions of power. A lot of the prescriptions for the unrest during the Warring States period, and this was the period when the text was written, and indeed many of the early Chinese philosophies arose, it challenges a lot of the approaches that they promote people to power, and when they promote people to power, it often goes with a particular set of values, the strong, the powerful, the male. And in that regard, the Tao Te Ching seems to want to overturn these normative expectations and behaviors. It also, in that regard, challenges the conceptual framework of detachment. It views these approaches as extremely divisive. Within human society, to promote some is to leave others behind, and so on and so forth. And the Tao Te Ching sees this as, you know, methods that lead to severe fragmentation of society. In that case, the notions of Tao and De, where De, as I explained earlier, refers to a kind of the power of the individual. It's what's inherent in the individual that can be used or applied. It applies the notion of De to suggest a self within the environment that it believes better captures the nature of human flourishing. One good example, and this example is an example from cooking. I love this example. It's from a very early text, and it's about soup. Genuine harmony is like soup, is the title of that example. It discusses, you know, the elements that go in a soup, you know, vinegar, ginger. In a Chinese soup, you probably have some vinegar, ginger, salt, and so on and so forth. And if you just take the example of ginger, when you put it into a pot of soup, the ginger loses its distinctiveness as a piece of ginger. However, the taste of ginger now permeates the soup. And so Taoism tends to see potency or power, the of an individual, that piece of ginger, as being much more far-reaching and much more integrated and much more interdependent with the entire environment than, you know, the necessity of keeping its essence to itself, so to speak.
Karen Lai from the University of New South Wales. Curiously, when I asked Professor Wang Keping about the relevance of the Tao to our times, he too turned to culinary metaphor.
I'm thinking about several elements which may bear certain kind of relevance to our reality now. But I will think of one particular element, that is the political dimension. Okay, for instance, Lao's talks about political administration in different ways. And as far as the governance is concerned, he argued that governing a large country is just like cooking a small fish. But by cooking a small fish, it's not meant to do something easy. It's meant, in fact, not to disturb the people from time to time by introducing different rules, regulations, and whatever. For instance, just like tax or, you know, some other things, and even ideological control or whatever. And secondly, talking about the leadership, he has a very interesting view. He said that there could be three kinds of leadership. The best one is to be heard or remains unknown to the populace because they have done a good job. People just live their life. So the second best is praised and glorified. And then the third is not the best. The third, the worst, is condemned and possibly bullied by the populace because they're not very happy about that. And then talking about there's also the democratic element there, and say the leadership should not have fixed mind. They should take the mind of the people as their mind. I think that's a very interesting argument there. So you should really not simply listen to the public opinion on the one hand. You have to really think what the people really think. They're not simply, you know, economic creatures, okay? They're also social, political, and even spiritual beings. They have different kinds of needs. You can't just confine themselves, okay, as long as I can give you some bread, you'll be okay. So I think that's a very interesting idea.
The Tao and Our Needs. That was Wang Keping, professor at the Beijing International Studies University. The show is produced by Kyla Slavin. The technical engineer who knows the way of the mixing desk is Charlie McCune. I'm Alan Saunders, and I'll be back next week.